Okay, thank you for staying. I will do my best to get through this in a timely manner. I want to thank the organizers for putting this together. It's been a pleasure. I've never attended an Anacapa Society meeting. It's been wonderful, and I've enjoyed all the conversations with people, and I've actually adapted the talk, given some of the feedback I had throughout the week, to address some of these questions that people have had. So in particular, I'll talk about some field theory issues and length scales, let you guys know, and idea about trace in some of these cases, an exact method with the Monte Carlo. I've sort of thrown that in to help out. So I'm not going to provide a lot of details about what I do in these calculations. I'm going to try to keep it general, some big ideas, and I'll introduce the idea of frustrations that build up complexity. And then at the end, I'll show some results for one of the projects I've been working on. But I won't go through all of them. Obviously, if anybody wants to talk about the details, it'd be great. And we already have a little bit with some people. But so I do want to say that over the years, I've worked with an enormous number of people. And I would like to put their names up there. There's just too many. But one in particular I will point out is a postdoc advisor from years ago, Michel Gingras. I still work with him quite a lot. And so he's the one person with whom I really do owe a lot, to whom I owe a lot. So I'll go through some general ideas about about frustration and work on down the line into itinerant systems. Stuff on materials, it's going to be very brief, just to let you know that a lot of what motivates this field is what we see in material systems. Now, they could be crystalline, but also a lot of things now are being synthetically fabricated, so through lithography techniques, okay? Thin film technology, that's possible now. But there's also a strong link to just fundamental physics here, okay? And so it varies. And then I'll introduce the model and some select results. I guess let me just state up front that I will talk mainly about stuff that I've been doing with my small group and largely alone on some of these issues. And so when I'm talking about that, what I'm really interested in is sort of looking at how frustration affects these low temperature phases in model systems. And what I want to do is I want to look at models to where I can tune that parameter, okay, to see what's happened in a situation, for example, which is not frustrated. They could order, they could not. And then what does frustration do to those phases when you can dial it up? So an anisotropic type of lattice is something that will be, it's key to my work so far. Okay, so this is a simple picture that I've used before in dealing with students about what frustration is. So this is where I'll start down at the bottom, so I apologize if it's too simplistic. But you just typically have to have a rule. So you have certain balls, red and blue. In this case, I'll talk about up-down spins in a minute. And you have a rule, which is just another word for your Hamiltonian. And the rule is that the nearest neighbors, depending on how you stack them, they've got to be of opposite color, right? So if you stack them this way, direct stacking is what I call it, you can satisfy that rule, and there's no problem. But if you stack it the other way, right, a dense packing, you can't, okay? And you can arrange this in many different ways. So just by adjusting the geometry of your system, depending on what the rule is, of course, you can induce frustration. And then, of course, that means that there's no sort of unique way. This obviously has symmetry of flipping red and blue, but this can have multiple options, okay? So if you take that step and talk about magnetism. So magnetism, frustration of magnetism has been around since about 1933, right? Yeah, concepts of it. So it's been around for a while. And of course, the field of magnetism is much older. But the Ising, and some people pronounce it Ising, I typically call it Ising, but model is sort of the simplest approach to demonstrate this phenomena. And again, red, blue is up, down, okay? It's all classical. The type of interactions that which you need are antiferromagnetic, right? So for the lowest state, so you want these spins to sort of anti-align in that case. And again, for antiferromagnetism, it just means that up and down is what you're going to have to minimize the interaction. You put it on a square, you're fine, right? So that's the antiferromagnetic order. But as soon as you just change the geometry to something that's triangular, you could put down spins that do satisfy your Hamiltonian, your microscopic interaction, but you can't do it for all of them. And of course, this can resonate. Either way, you have disorder. All right. If that continues in the ground state, I'll talk about that briefly. That is, you have residual entropy in this case. Another way to get at frustration is not solely from the geometry, but you can throw in longer range interactions, and they can compete. So the simplest version of this is called a J1, J2 model. Now, if Trinajan were here, he could talk a lot more about this, because he'd worked with Kyung-Suk Majumdar on interacting spin waves on the J1, J2, I think J3 quantum Heisenberg model, right? So you could put in your Hamiltonian, you put in long-range exchange. And for this one, if you start off by saying, all right, I'll just put it on a square lattice, and you just have J1, you turn off J2. By the way, J2 in this case is across the diagonal both ways. You get the anti-ferromagnet, it's no problem. But as soon as you turn it on, you do get these, and the question is, how strong? What happens, right? And you don't know. You have to look at it, but that's a frustrating interaction. So another big theme is that competing interactions in your Hamiltonian can also lead to frustration, even if the lattice itself doesn't change, right? Okay. Again, any questions at any time, just pipe up. So I want to do a little bit more on this simple model to show you how things can change and what will happen with your sort of like energy states with frustration. I want to illustrate a couple points. So very simplistic. I'm going to take the exchange interaction. If you do mean field calculation, you'd have to Fourier transform J. And if you look at where the minimum of this is at, right, it gives you an idea of ordering wave vector. And if you actually did this mean field calculation in real space, you could look at a spin structure. But realize, when I do this, I'm not looking at fluctuations in this case, right? So I just Fourier, I'm going to tune the frustration. And I'm going to look at the two models, which I just talked about, J1, J2. On a square lattice, and anisotropic triangular lattice. So I'm actually plotting that. So it's in the Brillouin zone, right? If you like, I write label as L and H, which and O, and I projected it down, right? So the intensity, right? You look at your minimum, you find out it comes out at pi. In this case, it's anti-ferromagnetic order, which you'd expect. So the structure's there, and you can keep turning that up. And the minimum change in your model, but it's still pi, right? But then when you get to this very interesting point at a half, you get an enormous degeneracy all the way around this edge of the Brillouin zone. And you see this in J1, J2 models, not just Ising, it's in Heisenberg, it's classical, it's quantum, whatever, right? It's very interesting. So you've tuned it to a particular point, it's disordered. But as soon as you move off and still increase it, I went all the way, this case, to where it's equal. You actually get another ordered phase, which pi, 0, 0, pi. It'll work out because of the connectivity. So you can tune this model to be right at some highly frustrated and essentially disordered point. You can move it off. Yeah, Nate.
I'm sorry, can you say again, what is plotted on the...
Okay, so I Fourier transformed the exchange, and this is just the values of Q. If you like QX, QY, and I just did in the Brillouin zone.
Okay.
Right?
The X and Y components.
X and Y components of the momentum.
Are you calling them H and L because you're perverse?
Yeah, no. No, that's just standard to list them, right? It's a factor of 2 pi over A, the lattice constant, right? The Miller indices, right? It's common if you look, neutron scattering is big in the field because that tells you a lot about magnetic structure. It's the most reliable way to look at it. When you look at these plots, they're typically well listed in H, K, L. There's a factor of 2 pi or some factor that's been thrown in. But yes, good question. Any others? Okay. So if I go to the anisotropic lattice, the triangular one, so just to point out, to take this, turn the square into a triangular lattice, go across one diagonal, okay? Topologically, it's the same as just taking a triangular lattice, right? This corner, edge-shared equilateral triangles. You get the same thing. The reason why I do it is because I want the The zone is still square. If I went to a triangle, it would be hexagonal, right? I don't want to point out those distinctions at the moment, right? But anyway, like I said, if this were actually off, right, you still get pi. And now you can keep tuning it up. It still stays. And it stays up until a half. So let me go back and say up to about 0.5. You still have this anti-Farrell line, but it looks like it's degenerate, a line of nodes, modes coming out, right, Q5. But it's not quite. If you look at it closely enough, it's the minimum really is at pi. But then once you do that above it, then you now have a situation. So you can do this, right? And it's frustrated, but now as you move off of it, I'm not only going to go to the fully frustrated case at the end. It looks like, oh, there's a mode. I mean, there's a minimum there. It's at some, you know, wave vector. Again, this is sort of mean field theory. You say, oh, it must be a nice ordered pattern. But you can't do that with up and down spins. And if you look closely at it, the spin structure, you find out that you can satisfy part of it. And actually what you can do is you can satisfy the honeycomb sum structure of the triangular lattice. That's where you can put the anti-Farrell magnetism. And then the other right sites, they're going to be random between up and down. That's one possible mode. So if you want to know the details, these older papers by Vonnier and Hooptapel, I guess I don't know how to pronounce that. But this was actually a handful of years after Onsager's solution for the 2D Ising model. They look at the solution on a triangular lattice, isotropic, and they figure out the residual entropy in the model. Okay, so that's a key point in a lot of frustrated magnetic systems and anything dealing with spin liquids. It's a big term within the field now, is that spin liquid has, well, there are many things. It's sort of defined by what it's not, but essentially it has some sort of the residual entropy in the ground state. You could have classical spin liquid systems or quantum. So, yeah.
I can see the three blues and three reds on every hexagon.
That's right.
And then I see the dots in the middle of each hexagon that are black that you say are random. Why can't you put an anti-ferromagnetic series of red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, right down that line of dots?
I picked one of the allowed phases from it. There are others which he talks about. Vonnier, I was following sort of Vonnier's paper.
Vonnier, yeah.
But there are. This is not the only phase that gives you this energy.
Okay, but in this phase, you could put a string of anti-ferromagnetic spins right down the upper left to lower
right. You mean
right
like
diagonal?
This one?
Yeah, and the next one, yeah.
No.
Oh, they don't care because they have no interaction.
It
doesn't change.
Okay, well, you'd want them to cancel out, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't do anything because
the lines are
the interactions.
The nearest
it looks nice, but it doesn't make any difference in the energy.
Zero moment, zero net field, rather, acting on that site. Right, so. Okay. Oh, yeah, Alex, sorry. Yep.
Why are you just looking at the anisotropic triangular lattice? Is it just that this is, I look at your model and it seems like all that matters is really the topology, not the geometry, or the connectivity, not the specific geometry. Is it just for ease of display doing everything in a rectangular coordinate system, or is there something I'm missing?
Good question. I am doing it mainly for to discuss, essentially define what frustration is, and that one mode of it is the lattice geometry, right? I picked representing the triangle lattice this way only for sort of the discussion purposes, because I did the square lattice first. So from that perspective, if I just wanted to actually work with triangles, I could, but then when it ordered, I couldn't say, oh, it's pi, it's at a different part of the zone because the lattice vectors are all different. But that's one.
But this is equivalent to, is this equivalent to a regular triangular lattice? Okay.
Yes.
With J1, J2 equal to each
other. Yeah.
You can also
Yes.
use J2.
Yes. That's right. If I tune J2 and turn off J1, right, so I get chains. I get independent chains. Hmm. Right. And I've done that in my these Hubbard model calculations. But there I work with an actual the triangular lattice. Okay. So I just want to let you know I've worked on spin ice a fair amount over the years, and this is where the Waterloo group I've done a lot with, and I just want to point, this is a very simple discussion. A lot has gone on with spin ice over the years, and I've focused on sort of the microscopics. There's a lot of field theory work that goes on this. By the way, this is where the excitations of magnetic monopoles come out in these systems. So just as a, so I don't get, if you want to get the question, or right, we don't have del dot B is not zero, it's del dot H, right, which is not zero in this case, and they're excitations, because you have a fluctuating magnetization. So you have del dot H, that's what they're associated with, okay? We haven't changed Maxwell's equations. But this is for a simple system comparatively. I didn't write up the full Hamiltonian, but these rare earth systems have large magnetic moments, holmium and dysprosium titanate. But within the crystal structure of this pyrochloratus, which is basically corner-connected tetrahedra, all right, the crystal field effects are very large, and the Ising component is that the spins can point along a quantization axis, but the quantization axis is local. They point into, if you like, the tetrahedron, okay? And the reason why it's called spin ice is because these guys have residual entropy. So this is the same sort of Fourier transform of a far more complicated Hamiltonian. This one is only with nearest neighbor interaction, so it could be exchange plus dipoles cut off at first. The spectrum is completely flat, so it's degenerate entirely, okay? All modes would be the same. If you turn on long-range dipoles, and actually you have to treat them properly because this dipolar interaction is not well-behaved, so you have to turn into absolutely convergent series, right? So when you do that, you find out that you lift the degeneracy. I should point out, by the way, the ordering wave vector is at the maxima in the energy there because of the sign of the Hamiltonian that I had, right? It was just, I didn't want to go back and redo that calculation. Right? But you can lift the degeneracy slightly, and it comes out at this thing of 2 pi, but it's 0, 0 along the z, right? But it has multiple different stackings, if you like. But it's quasi-degenerate, because the difference here is, you know, a fraction of a percent inside the zone. But this leads to very interesting physics, right? Now, the model in this system will order, right? So the colleague who's now actually the organizer of the one of the other workshop here on entropy, Roger Melko, he did this for his master's thesis in the Monte Carlo calculation of loop moves to figure out where the phase transition was at. It's at point, it's 180 millikelvin in the model. But the materials, they do not order. Okay, but we can't get down that cold, okay? So there's no violation in the system of the third law, but we haven't been there yet. But again, I want to point out, you Ising model, it looks very simple, but in real materials, it really does hold, okay? I should point out the reason why it's Ising is that it's ground state doublet. When you look at the ions, is, you know, it's a doublet in ground state. The excited state up for the fluctuations is on the order of 250 Kelvin. So you're never, there's no fluctuations up, right? So in this case, it truly is Ising-like, yeah.
So I'm trying to understand the difference here. These are still Fourier transforms of your coupling
same thing.
Exchange constant. And on the left you have...
Only nearest neighbor interactions. Throw in the dipoles if you want, but yes.
And that is in this corner sharing tetrahedra pyrochlor lattice, right? And so what is different here?
I've turned on four long range dipoles, a dipolar interaction. So it falls off as 1/r³.
So it's not Ising model anymore.
No, it is an Ising model. The spin have Ising Z2 symmetry, right? But yeah, no, the Hamiltonian is far more complicated. All right. Okay. All right. I only want to say here that I don't want to go into detail about this because this could go on. I just want to say that I've talked about classical and Ising. You could repeat all these discussions with a higher symmetry. Classical, you could go quantum mechanics. And what's nice about building up this structure is that, you know, there's going to be links to the classical, to the quantum, and then to the itinerant. Right? I do that a lot myself to sort of compare to what goes on in the quantum model. So the spin one half models is what I typically try to do. You here, what you can then have, of course, is that spins can sort of compromise. And you can get all possible spin textures, you name it, right? There's a lot, the topological order, right? And different types of phase transitions, but a lot, right, that goes on, and the field is rich. Okay, for itinerant electrons, you have to go to a different sort of a system, and the standard model is the Hubbard model. And so really, you could put in multiple orbitals that could exist within your lattice. So you could have orbital magnetic or spin and charge degrees of freedom. If you want to model a particular material, yes, you might need to do it. For the purposes of this discussion, I'm going to stick with a single band. So all I have are charge and spin degrees of freedom. And so this is this kinetic energy or hopping term, because there's a sort of a, if you go through the full calculation, starting with the many-body Schrodinger equation and work your way down, you've thrown in sort of the generic interaction with the ionic lattice here. So anyway, but it's particularly, you know, essentially kinetic energy. I've restricted the Coulomb interaction to nearest neighbor. It's the strongest, but of course, you could turn it up. The chemical potential is really a decision of whether or not you want to work in the grand canonical ensemble in these cases or the canonical ensemble. I've done both, right? So even when I work in the grand canonical ensemble, to compare back to zero temperature calculations, I work at a fixed filling. So I want to make sure that things are sort of self-consistent. So anyway, you've added more complexity to your system. And with the hopping, so how does frustration kick in, basically, is that by being able to hop around your lattice, right? And so speaking to Courtney, if you want to do perturbation theory, this is sort of the next slide, these hopping terms on a particular sort of lattice geometry in strong interactions lead to ring exchange terms in a more complicated Heisenberg model, which is very important for aspects of superconductivity and various parts of the phase diagram, many other systems. But if you can hop, okay, you can reduce your energy. The antiferromagnetic on the square lattice is great, there's no problem. But here, of course, I can't hop. It's not because of the U, it's because of the Pauli exclusion principle, right? So can't do it, right? So you get frustration this way. It's kinetic, and it's strictly quantum mechanical in this case, right? And so, all right, what happens, right? That's sort of the question that I'm interested in. So this is the other little phase diagram. I just want to point out the Hubbard model. It is actually linked to some very important models, Heisenberg TGA and Heisenberg models that are studied for many purposes, to match up with material systems or for just strictly theoretical discussion. And what's nice about the Hubbard model is you can go sort of interpolate between the, or go from one regime of a metal to an insulator, but you also can talk about, you know, link to different models. What's important here, you don't have to always do this with the Hubbard model, it depends on where you sit, but if you're at half filling, which is an average of one electron per site in your model, simple band theory, that's always a metal. But you have electron-electron interactions, and when that's the case, you can get to a point to where the electron-electron interactions force you into an insulating state. So it's an interaction-driven case. It's MOT. So it's sort of the found, if you want to look, one way to look at it, you can go from the second quantized form back to your quantum magnets. And you can even go from the classical to the quantum magnets, nice simple adjustment or scaling of the spin. I think, actually, a friend told me a few years ago that Michael Fisher, many years ago, I've read the paper, it's American Journal of Physics, 60s or something, he derives the classical Heisenberg model from the quantum. He's, the rumor is that that's his most highly cited paper, so which just says something, right? Okay. So am I not going too fast or trying to get out of here? I know, but okay. Materials, you could do an entire talk on the materials that are important to frustrated magnetism and the motivation. I thought I'd fill it up, but no, I'm not going to, okay? Let me just state that I'm strictly sort of quantum systems. I got rid of the spin ice and large moment materials. But you have these quantum, stream quantum magnets, and they have sort of triangular and Kagome systems. And so these are, you know, insulators. The Herbert-Smithite, the capellicite, which is just a, I'd call it a polymorph of it. The Herbert-Smithite has attracted a lot of attention in the last few years because it looks like it's an ideal, as close as you can get to real material. Now, optical lattice people, they've been able to actually generate clean systems in this case. But for a material system, it looks like the Kagome, which I'll show you a picture of the Kagome lattice in a minute. But it's an experimental realization of an isotropic Kagome lattice. And the question is, what does it do in the ground state? In a model, we don't know what it does for spin 1/2, but it looks like it's actually gapped. That's sort of the gapped spin liquid state. But there's still a debate about that. For me, the attenuate systems, the triangular lattice, there are these, there's these cobaltates, which are far more complicated than a simple single band model. But also about these, actually, if you hydrate it, you can turn it into a superconducting system as well. Strange metal phenomena. But these organic systems, and it's a little bizarre, so they're quite soft, but what you have are these large, and I didn't write up the name, but maybe I should have, it's a long organic name for this molecule. It sits on a sort of a triangular structure, and it actually behaves like a single band Hubbard model in certain limits because of these holes that hop around. So it's pretty amazing that the experiments match with certain, the model matches fairly well some of the experimental data. So interesting little twist on that. Okay, so field theory. I just wanted to point this out. People had asked about this because many people do study field theory. I pulled this from a very nice review by Powell and McKenzie on these organic mod insulators, triangular lattice systems. And so depending on how you want to, and they did this for the Mott insulating system. So I apologize because I guess it's a little hard to see, but depending on what scale you want to look at the problem, you sort of choose your method. You could look at it from the quantum chemistry point of view and you look at Schrodinger's equations, right? But I look at it from this microscopic model perspective as a lattice. And so then I would be looking at a Hamiltonian, again, the Hubbard model. But if your length scales are, or the physics you're interested in is a longer length scale, you can go to a continuum field theory and investigate the system in a similar manner, all right? And this, I guess, is, I don't know, others can kinematically sort of correct me, but it's pretty common in the field that depending on, you have your problem at what sort of length scale you'd like to look at the system or in which direction you'd like to approach, you know, the point of interest, a critical point. So, all right, there are many, many ways to study these systems. And I'm basically sticking in this direction, that component there, the lattice model. Okay. So, I've already said a few of these things. The Hubbard model, so a few more details. You can study it many, many ways. Like I said, you can transform it to some other effective field. To have some effective field theory and study it. That way, numerics are big. I focused a lot on the mean field approaches, so that's where I've done, in Monte Carlo a little bit. So let me point out a couple things about when studying the Hubbard model, whether it's the mean field approach, or I'll stick with sort of the numerics, okay? I'm not conversant on these other field theoretic techniques for the system. The problem lies in the interaction. It's a fully interacting many-body problem. How are you going to deal with it, okay? A number of techniques, and this is where I want to, next slide, I want to talk about QMC, you need to break this down. And so, you have to treat the full Hamiltonian. The kinetic energy you can deal with, right, can easily just diagonalize, it's a one-body problem. So you diagonalize it, keep it aside for your calculations, okay? So that's this, so Arthur was talking about what does it mean to trace out. You're tracing out those degrees of freedom, that's the statement, okay? That doesn't give you the problem. The question is, how are you going to deal with this two-body interaction? Because remember, it has the, I guess I should have put this up, the number operators is a, you know, calculating, you know, destruction creation operator, right? So you have four, it's a four operator, right, body interaction. So you break it up with this Hubbard-Strachanovitz transformation. This is one of them. There are others, okay? And so you've converted it to a one-body term. There's this probability rate that you put in. But these X here, these are your Hubbard-Stratonovich fields. They're classical fields. They're Ising-like. They're up-down. Now, you could change that symmetry. It doesn't have to be up-down, right? But that's what you replace the interaction with. You could do this in analytic calculation, but you could also do it in a Monte Carlo. Where does the Monte Carlo come in? You sample these guys from a distribution, right? And then you update it, and then you use it in your calculation, right? And so anytime you're dealing with fermions, in that case, you've got something like that. The standard QMC, the two that I know the best, the first one is sort of what we call determinant Monte Carlo. So it's Blakenbecker, Scalapino, and Sugar were the three people that came up with this, published in PRD many years ago. And so it's a finite temperature algorithm in this case, right? Which means you could also do do imaginary time, right, in this case, and then analytically continue back if you want to. It's a lot of work, but you don't necessarily have to do that. But, you know, you put your operators in, you trace over the fields and you trace over the states, and you get your interactions out. The problem is that the weights associated in this calculation are determinants, and the determinants are not guaranteed, are not positive definite. And so you could have negative weights popping in, okay? What you do in these calculations, and you carry that sign of the determinant around in your calculations with your observables, okay? And for this type of calculation, that's the origin of the sign problem, okay? Depending on your quantum Monte Carlo method, the sign problem takes on a different form, okay? There's one approach to getting, you don't solve, there is no solution to the sign problem, but there is a way to sort of minimize the impact. And one of them is to put in some sort of a fixed node. So you have a sampling function in which you'll generate. So this constrained path or constrained phase, so a little different in that it's actually a ground state algorithm. It's not a finite temperature algorithm, this one. So you project out. But when you do, if your weights ever come up negative, right, you try to exclude them by checking you, right, against some trial state. You say, okay, here's the nodes in my many body wave function. If that overlap is negative, I just skip it, okay? It turns out to be an uncontrolled approximation. Not great, but you can't, in many cases, you can't do any better, okay? So, again, I'm not going to go into the details of this. I've worked on these. There are a number of problems. But, and just to sort of demonstrate with the sign problem, going back to the determinant algorithm, if you put it on a completely isotropic triangular lattice at half filling, and so where the sign problem is going to be terrible because frustration is going to make the sign problem even worse, okay? Sign problem depends on a lot of parameters. Temperature, right, so this is inverse beta, or inverse temperatures, it's beta. The filling, a lot of things it depends on, right? But this is where the average sign is. You can see the lattice size and the interaction strength, lattice is 6, it's small. But interaction strength is U is 6, it dies off really quickly. And you're not even at very low temperature, and that's what you're interested in, right? It's not going to work. So I think sort of the best description of the what is the essentially the sign problem, you know, Malvin Kalos told me this years ago, is that the signal to noise just, it dies. Whatever your method is, anything that you're measuring, it goes to zero, right? So the error bars get to be so big, it's essentially pointless, right? It's an unsolved problem, okay? So I have done some of that, but I've decided to do mean field, and so I'm going to treat the interaction term, and I'm doing a Hartree-Fock type of mean field theory, and so I'm just going to decompose this interaction term and sort of average values, and I do it to keep the spin rotational symmetry as well, okay? Then, of course, you have to, when you do this, and I create a free energy, a Helmholtz free energy in this case. So I, do the Legendre transformation back because I want to keep it at fixed filling in this case. I compare to the canonical ensemble. Anyway, you have self-consistent equations. You make this huge matrix, which goes as if you have n sites in your model or your lattice. You have 2n, by 2N matrix, and the 2 comes from the fact that both spin species are carried along, right? Diagonalize it, you get your right states out, you solve self-consistently for this and set by some set convergence parameter, right? So you, you know, the faster you can go, the better. But there's no sign for it. Fluctuations are out, so be careful, right? What you get in mean field theory will not necessarily be what you get once you crank up any sort of interaction channel, or excuse me, fluctuation channels, right? Yeah.
The second line, where do those terms come from?
I'm doing the full decomposition. This is a rotationally invariant decomposition of N up and N down. A lot of times, so it's a good question. A lot of times what you'll see is that people do not put that line in, right? Then it's only spin up and spin down, essentially. But really, the full decomposition of the Hart tree, fuck, is you have this. All right. So now I can actually just spin flip states, and I can get non-collinear states out. So I'm not doing too bad. I need to step through, but there's only a few things left. At this level with itinerant systems, I'm sticking with 2D, okay? And the frustrated lattices that I'm really so far interested in are the triangular. So that's the form, right, that I work with, this sort of true geometry of the lattice. The hopping is now anisotropic. Okay, the kagome are corner connected. It's a lattice of corner sharing triangles. Okay, and again, you tell me the level of the hopping along different directions, right? I want it right now. It's sort of I'm going to be looking at it in terms of interest in models and comparing back to spin systems. The data I'm going to show you though next is strictly for the isotropic case. But at an interesting filling fraction, it's an average of 2/3 electrons per site. And what I should point out, because I didn't include this, I should have, but I could break this triangular lattice down into a lattice, another triangular lattice with a 3-atom basis. So I could have a sub-lattice structure of 1, 2, and 3. And that's because I can have sort of a honeycomb structure carried out of it. Because at 2/3 filling, it's an average, you could disperse their electrons, right? So I could put them all throughout the lattice. Ways, but they can also occupy only a honeycomb substructure, and the other sites would be vacant. All right, honeycomb lattice is not frustrated; it's bipartite. Okay. So I apologize to some of the. It's only a couple slides, but doing these self-consistent calculations is called a third filling. In this case, if I look at the charge density on a sublattice, so one of those 1, 2, 3. And what I'm doing is I'm subtracting off the average. So the average is the 2/3, okay? So I want to know deviations from a uniform distribution of charge. Is this thing going to order in some sense of charge? And as a function of U, I did this, by the way, in the grand canonical ensemble, but extremely low temperatures. I've compared it to the canonical ensemble as well, and it matches, right? But you'll see that sort of there's no deviation from the average, which means it's a uniform distribution. But depending on the value of the interaction strikes, this area, not exactly sure, it's trying to remain maybe in some sort of a 120-degree canted state dealing with the frustration. That's what the spin structure looks like when I pop it out, okay? But at a strong enough U, what it does is it, right, separates off into, you know, certain, because that's the charge, the magnetization, the sublattice magnetization is the exact same thing, okay? And what happens is that on one of the sublattices, so 2 here, right, 1, 2, and 3, label a sublattice. So the magnetization on sublattice 2 is 0 at this regime. And on magnetization on sublattice 3 is, you know, a negative value. On 1, it's the exact opposite but plus, right? So what you have is an anti-ferromagnet. And of course, you can see these are compressibility and entropy in these cases. It dies off when it orders. But notice that the compressibility and entropy in this regime here, where it's still hasn't fully ordered, if you like, is finite. Okay.
Why are those curves identical?
No, scale is different, right?
Oh, they're just the same type.
Type of calculation, but.
So, compressibility and entropy per.
Per site in this case.
Per site.
Yeah.
Follows the same pattern. They're not identical curves.
No, they are not identical curves.
Okay.
but it's an interesting point. I look at the charge-charge correlations as it scales, look for a gap, like what's a metal, what's an insulator. And so depending on how it scales, you go from metal to insulator. And so to figure out where the transition might be, I looked at this at different regimes. I don't want to crowd it too much. But I get a critical interaction strength of about 5.15 roughly, for it to go from a metal to actually a charge-ordered magnetic insulator, finite temperature properties, really quickly, I repeat the same thing. I guess the one thing to note, I don't worry about so much about these, but with charge deviation, you see actually a sort of a discrete jump. And the magnetization is temperature goes linear until it actually gets to that transition to the charge-ordered state. So it looks like a first-order transition, because in mean field theory, if you look at the magnetism as a function of temperature, it's supposed to have that nice one, curved path, so the exponent is a half. So sort of based on that, it looks like it's a first-order. By the way, for those who do know it, the Merman-Wagner theorem tells you that if you have a continuous symmetry in two or lower dimensions, you can't have a finite temperature phase transition. But what I'm breaking here is not a continuous symmetry. I'm breaking a discrete lattice symmetry. So it's fine. And that's why, you look at the... So the charge-ordered structure looks like this, I look at 4.6 on well below transition. It's paramagnetic. Basically, magnetization is zero, and the charge is evenly distributed, as you might expect. It's a metallic regime. But once you get into above, at the critical point, what happens is that, so the red and the blue are magnetized. There's a little bit extra on one sublattice, there's extra charge, but there's also spin up and spin down. And it's picked out the honeycomb lattice. So what you have is frustration in this case has driven it to pick out, the bipartite structure in the system. So charge orders as well. So it happens together. It's not always the case in magnetic systems to where you can get both itinerant systems where you get ordering of charge and ordering of magnetism. So the high TC materials, especially in this weird, I call it the strange metal phase, coming out of the quantum critical point, there's a lot of interesting things that goes on there, but it's a totally different area. So you can see it in this case as being driven strictly by frustration. So I'm going to stop there. I mean, we could talk more about other things, stuff that needs to, approaches you could take to continue studying this model, but I need to actually write, especially this prof on the charge ordering, all the data is there and there's a draft there, but it needs to get out, and there's other stuff on anisotropic triangular Kagome lattices, which I'm collecting are essentially, one of them is almost done. But to go further, I guess, we could talk with others. Quantum Monte Carlo is really maybe not the best route to go. It's just the sign problem kills you. But with the Waterloo group, we've done this recently with a big, not a spin ice compound, but with a gadolinium titanate, which gadolinium is a rare earth metal which has full rotational symmetry. And it has one of these situations where it's partially ordered or disordered. So it looks like it has a soft mode, a wave vector. But not all the sites are ordered. There's a randomness in it, And you can use these extended types of mean field. But extensions to mean field because you're building back in fluctuations. And one of them is Onsager's reaction field, Put that back in. But there's also these other techniques done by Fowler, Anderson, and Palmer, which are used for spin glasses, Can you apply these to fermion systems? It's another way. Because another option as well, these very sophisticated cluster dynamical mean field calculations. And that's another whole group of, that's a set of tools and expertise, which is difficult to come by. But anyway, sorry, I went on longer than I thought. But
When you say you do mean field theory, you really do mean field theory with quantum fluctuations included perturbatively, right? Because you turn your Hamiltonian into a quadratic one, and
okay.
You diagonalize that, right?
Yep, but I don't see where the fluctuations come. There's a quantum mechanical effect, but I'm not putting in, so I'm dealing with this, the field, yeah, the spin or the charge can vary itself, but it interacts with an average.
Right, right, so it's the process of turning your Hamiltonian into a quadratic one instead of one with four operators somewhere.
Oh, yes, okay, yes.
So can I think of it as like a, like in boson land, when you have classical degeneracies and you include quantum fluctuations, it can lift the degeneracies. So I imagine what happens here is something like that effect when you have frustration in the quantum problem. If you would still have,
oh, okay.
You would still have like a classical frustration if you did full mean field theory and turned it into a classical problem. But including some quantum fluctuations breaks that degeneracy.
That's a good point.
I don't know if it's a point. It's more of a question. Like, is that what's happening?
Well, let me just. I didn't show you these results, but I did a lot of work as well on the triangular lattice. And if you look at the triangular lattice, I get various states. It's called a Q equals zero state or root three by root three state. But when you compare it to a quantum spin system, right, to where you don't have the charge degrees of freedom, okay, it's different. All right. Actually, it's the Q equals zero phase. That in my case is the preferred ground state for an isotropic case. In quantum magnet, it's actually this root three stress. So what it is, it's rotated in some way so that if you traced out a unit cell and repeated it, it would have this root three type of structure. So we differ in this way from quantum magnets, even at the mean field level. Kagome system is also similar. I see phases in the Kagome system that I haven't seen anybody else know, like this 12-site lattice structure. So the distinction could be is that I have these extra degrees of freedom fluctuations that are absent in
the
magnetic.
So the same sort of treatment doesn't work if you don't have itinerant electrons?
Like, well, you would have a different type of mean field theory.
Yes.
Right? So you could apply mean field theory to many, but yeah, you don't have these charged or itinerancy.
And right. Does it work pretty well if you do that kind of mean field theory with fixed electrons?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's, I mean, you, yes.
Okay.
We could talk about it more, but
sure,
yeah, there are multiple ways of doing mean field theory for just the spins.
So you had one-third filling for Kagome lattice, or two-thirds?
No, the triangular lattice, I did it at this, interesting, because I knew that it traces out the honeycomb.
So you had maybe 18-site cluster?
I have,
L was 18?
What I showed you data for mainly on the triangular lattice was L equal 18 and 24 for most, but when I did some finite size scaling, I went up to what I showed you in the plot, I think it was 40, but I've gone as high as 60. Squared for the triangle.
Okay. So my question is, typically in these kind of mean field studies, you will see at the end a phase diagram, for example, in the space of density and interaction U, but you right now you only have one point, which is, you know, density two-thirds, and you find a phase transition at U equal 5.2. Have you tried to map out this phase diagram?
I've done it for the triangular lattice in terms of frustration. So you're right, what I did is for the triangular lattice, I'm putting an extra degree, so I could put, some people for these phase diagrams, if it's itinerant, they put the filling on one side and interaction on another if they do the ground state. If you want to do temperature, it's a third axis, but stick with the ground state. And you say, what are your phases in here? What I've done is I said, fix the filling. I put frustration, because the triangle lattice, as was said earlier, when I do the, I looked at both, I get the square lattice in this case. If I turn off T1 and I go like this, because the connectivity is four nearest neighbors, right? So if I start with the square and turn on T1, I can go to the triangle lattice. And once it's equal, it's isotropic. But I can also start with this being strong and turn down this, and I go from the triangular lattice to some sort of coupled chain system. So it can be quasi-1D. I've done both, right? But I didn't show you that data. That's correct. But I could do it with filling, and then I need another. I need a third axis.
Going back to your Hartree-Fock approximation, you mentioned that you have that second set of terms because you can do spin flip. You can allow that.
These are the right. You have a whether or not your state comes out with it. It's a,
right.
I wrote it in terms of the spin language, but that's actually written out in terms of create. So if you want to create a spin up, you have to come along, destroy the spin. You want to create a spin up, you got to destroy the spin down on that side.
Right, so you have a spin flip.
That's right.
But the original Hamiltonian doesn't have that. Right.
You can actually decompose this.
Right. But there's no spin flip in the original Hamiltonian. You have hopping and you have on-site interaction. My question is, why would you need the second set of terms?
The one way to do this is to think about it this way. Within the Hartree-Fock limit, all right, you want it. So you would, if you actually put this entire, normal ordered it and did Wick's theorem on this and did all the contractions, you would come out with these terms, right? And what you do is you define the mean field theory such that that average matches that, okay? And that's what we did. You could do the momentum space with the exact same thing. I didn't do momentum space yet, okay? But yes. Because I'm looking at averages in this case, you're correct.
Have you considered adding interactions between different sites? Because in the beginning, I remember you were mentioning that adding interaction between next nearest neighbors also can create frustration.
That's a good point. In wanting to, in the future, I haven't done it yet, but I've thought about it. So then you go to something called extended Hubbard model, multi-band model. If I'm interested in studying these really interesting charge ordered phases and these cobaltates, I have to, because the longer range interactions are necessary, and also it looks like it's multi-orbital system. So the level of complexity goes up. But for those organic materials, it looks like it is. The hopping is not uniform, right? So there's this anisotropy in it. But the interactions are it looks like everything tells us on site is the strongest, but yes.
I just have a quick comment. If you do Hartree-Fock, I don't know about how Wick's theorem gives you this, but if I did Hartree-Fock on that interaction Hamiltonian and I contracted my operators every way I could, I would get exactly what you have there, like, right? Because I would contract, kill spin down, create spin up, and that says S plus, and that would give me this.
Okay, this is the stupidest question, but it's been bothering me. You had something you passed over because it was a big word that was organic something or another, right? And it started with a K. Is it a ketamine or something? Remember? Way back. No. What?
Oh, and the materials part of it?
Yeah, the material. Yeah, there it was. That. God, it's hard to find.
This
there. What's K-ET sub 2? It's a long thing.
It's an organic molecule. It's
And K does stand for some part of that name that starts with
yes,
K?
Yes, because you can have, I was a chemist as an undergrad, but it's been a long time. You can have, cis trans sort of orientations across bonds and stuff. You've got a K phase or an alpha phase or a beta phase of the arrangements within this molecule. I'd have to bone up on my organic chemistry to define that for you, but.
Okay, so the K is like K phase of something or another.
Yes, yes.
ET is ethyl poietin triamine.
Trithiol diamine,
yeah, okay,
blah, 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 blah.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's all I need to know.
Yes. Thank you.